Let me finish this part and then I'll pause for some questions at the end of this chapter. So we have seen some modalities for imaging and established what we could do with the image data that we acquire. Now, in data acquisition and analysis, there are several important considerations, some technical and some non-technical, that we need to look into. In data acquisition, we have what could be called the human instrument system. Here, the word instrument is not applied to the human. There is the human and then there is the instrument. Okay. So it's not human as the instrument. And the two are put together in the experimental procedure. And there are some important considerations. The subject or the patient. The main purpose of imaging and image analysis is to provide a certain benefit to the subject. That is the most important consideration. Everything else is secondary. So safety of the human being and that particular purpose of providing a benefit to the human subject is of paramount importance. So all systems and procedures involved should be designed so as not to cause undue inconvenience to the subject and not to cause any harm or danger. Now note that it says not to cause any inconvenience, but undue inconvenience. So there is inconvenience caused. The question is how much is reasonable? There is a risk involved in every procedure. X-ray imaging will involve the passage of X-rays and X-ray dose to the patient. And a large amount of X-ray dose could cause cancer itself. So there is inconvenience, there is harm, and there is risk, but undue is the key here. So you have to explain to the patient what is involved and understand and appreciate the risks involved. And that must be confined to ranges that have been established to be acceptable. In applying invasive or risky procedures, it is extremely important to perform a risk-benefit analysis or a cost-benefit analysis and determine if the anticipated benefits. Now, it's only anticipated. We don't know. We cannot guarantee the benefits, but the anticipated benefits of the procedure are worth placing the subject at the risks that are involved. So for this, the patient needs to be informed. So there is an informed consent given by the patient to be subjected to all these procedures. The procedures I described involve these devices and systems. There are transducers, films, scintillation detectors, cameras, fluorescent screens, and all of these things that I have listed here. There will be signal conditioning equipment, amplifiers, photomultiplier tubes, filters, and so on. And then display equipment. Oscilloscopes are computer monitors or printers and special purpose display devices. Recording, data processing, and transmission equipment could be used. Film is a recorder, as well as a detector, analog to digital converters, digital to analog converters, and telemetry, and so on, and picture archival and communication systems in general for medical imaging systems. Then there are control devices, power supply stabilizers, isolation equipment, patient intervention systems, and so on. So these are all parts and components that go into the imaging system. There are several objectives that are involved. Information gathering. The first is simply knowledge discovery. Measurement of phenomena to interpret an organ, a process, or a system to understand, just for the sake of understanding and the advancement of science. Screening is specific, where you are investigating a large population of asymptomatic people. People who do not have any symptoms of any disease, but a general population or a selected population for the incidence of a certain type of disease. For example, school children in a certain age group. You may send healthcare workers to schools and you may get them to listen to heart sounds to check if the school children have any problems. And if they are not, most of the children there or most of the members of that population would be assumed to be normal. But there could be some situations or some cases where there may be problems. And you want to detect and catch them as early as possible from the general population. And this leads to, or the motive of this is early detection. For example, breast cancer. In Canada and parts of Europe, many countries have established breast cancer screening programs where asymptomatic women, women in the general population, but within a certain age group, in Canada it is from 50 years to 70 years, are invited to voluntarily participate in X-ray imaging of the breast every 2 years. Now, there are certain risks involved because of the use of X-rays. But the hope is that any breast cancer that develops in this general population would be caught early before the patient would discover it herself or before it metastasizes or before it becomes a bigger problem. That is known as screening. Diagnosis is another application which is different, where the detection or confirmation of malfunction, pathology or abnormality is the concern. In screening, you are examining a general population for some particular disease or abnormality. In diagnosis, the patient presents with a problem, and the physician has to investigate and figure out what is the problem and where is it and so on. So that is diagnosis. Monitoring is something else, and that is repeated examination over a certain period of time for monitoring the state of health or functionality or recovery of a patient. And this is to obtain periodic information about a system. After surgery, you monitor a patient every so many days or weeks. Or if you were to put an implant into a patient, you would want to monitor the condition, the state of the patient, and also the state of that implant device that you have put in, because even implants will have a certain finite lifetime and deteriorate over a certain number of years. So you need to figure out when the implant needs to be replaced with a new device or implant. So monitoring would require periodic information gathering or assessment or imaging of the patient. Therapy and control. In therapy or treatment, the aim is modification of the behavior of a system. You are going to apply some treatment method or protocol, chemotherapy or some drugs or surgery, and you want to modify a system, treat a disease, or improve the physiological condition and functioning based upon the outcome of the activities of these things, based upon the information you have gathered, such as image-guided therapy or computer-aided therapy or surgery. And then evaluation. Objective analysis to determine the ability to meet certain functional requirements could be a normal individual, such as an athlete. You want to determine if a particular athlete can perform a certain task efficiently and within certain constraints or certain parameters that represent that function, the speed of running or whatever it is. So evaluation is another aspect where these same techniques could be used to study the behavior of a system and perform objective analysis of that system to perform some task or in performing a certain task. This is also to obtain proof of performance that this athlete can do such and such an activity in such and such a time, consuming so much oxygen and so on. One other application of evaluation is quantify the effect of treatment. In one of our projects, we have studied the effect of chemotherapy on a tumor known as neuroblastoma, or the tumor due to a form of pediatric cancer known as neuroblastoma, where the tumor is shrunk, reduced in size by therapy, and also the tissue composition of the tumor changes in response to therapy. So we not only want to analyze the size of the tumor, which is reducing, but also how is the tissue composition changing? How much of the tumor is actual tumor still, cancer? Excuse me. How much is necrosis, dead tissue? How much is calcified tissue? So we would like to analyze the tissue composition of the tumor over time in response to the treatment being applied. So the effect of treatment could also be quantified in the step of evaluation. All of these may be done using biomedical image data. The procedures that you apply could be categorized into a few different types, invasive or non-invasive. Invasive procedures involve the placement of devices or materials inside the body, such as the insertion of endoscopes, putting an imaging system inside the body. Catheter tip sensors, where a catheter is introduced into the heart to measure some parameter. X-ray contrast media that are injected into the body in subtraction angiography. In general, invasive procedures carry certain risks. When you inject a certain medium into the body, there is always a certain risk of allergic reaction or some infection. With X-rays, there is the risk of the use of associated with the use of ionizing radiation. In general, you would like non-invasive procedures, but there will be certain limitations in the nature of information you may gather with non-invasive procedures. Active versus passive procedures. Active procedures require external stimuli to be applied to the subject or require the subject to perform something. If you want to measure the activity of a muscle, the patient has to do something, some activity. If it is normal activity like moving the hand like this or swinging the leg, it's okay. It is acceptable, even if it causes some pain to the patient, because the patient has obviously come with some complaint and then you are asking the patient to do that thing which causes the pain. But that is considered to be part of the protocol. But if you are asking the patient to do something that stresses a system which is already not well beyond certain limits, then you must be prepared to handle that situation. For example, SPECT investigations of myocardial ischemia, when patients have a heart problem, putting the heart under stress could lead to some serious complications. The patient performs vigorous exercise on a treadmill. It's not simply moving the hand or contracting some muscles, but you're going to ask the patient to do vigorous exercise and then image the heart. And then it is possible that as the patient is exercising on the treadmill, that the patient may develop tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation. And then what do? You have to be prepared to handle that situation. So you need to be prepared for adverse reactions. The reason why you do it is an ischemic zone, that is a part of the heart where the blood supply is low, where the artery is constricted, is better delineated in SPECT images taken when the cardiac system is under stress than under normal conditions. So you want to stress the heart and then take the image, but there could be problems and they may cause pain, but some pain is tolerable. But if there is irreparable damage or death, then that is serious. In applying a certain mode of investigation, you wouldn't want to create those situations. So the investigator should be aware of such risks. There will always be some risk, and inform the patient and be prepared to handle adverse reactions. There is always a risk-benefit analysis. It is said that the moment you enter a hospital, there is only a finite chance that you will come out. It could be for a normal being 99.999%, but number of people who go into the hospital are already unwell and not all of them will come back alive. So there is a certain risk in everything. Passive procedures do not require the patient to do anything at all. And it would be good to have such systems, for example, recording the heart sound. It is a contact procedure. You have to put something in contact with the patient, such as a microphone. But then the patient doesn't have to do anything. The heart is beating normally anyway. You are just listening to it. The same with the EEG, the electroencephalogram. The brain is functioning on its own. You just attach electrodes and record. But of course, there must be proper grounding of the system so that when you attach your machine to the plug in the wall or put the plug in into the socket in the wall, there is no voltage coming back to the patient. So there must be proper isolation of the patient from the power supply. Non-contact procedures would be desirable too, such as thermal imaging, imaging from a distance. But all of these procedures may yield only limited information and may not provide you adequate information for the purposes that we saw just now. Most organizations require ethical approval by specialized committees for experimental procedures. At the University of Calgary, we have two different boards for ethics, and most universities have their own boards. And the healthcare system may have its own board. And for some of my studies, I've had to get multiple approvals from two different bodies, from the university and also the health board. In preparing the information for the ethics committee and consideration of the protocol for approval, one needs to be aware of these requirements: minimizing the risk and discomfort to the subject and maximizing the benefits to the subject and the investigator. If it is an experimental protocol related to research, then the investigator will also be drawing some benefits. If it is only treatment, then this is only to the subject. So that is about the data acquisition methods and protocol and systems and so on. Now let's come to the topic of interest in this course. With biomedical image analysis, the main goal is computer-aided diagnosis. Even if it is computer-aided detection, eventually there will be diagnosis performed using this information. So the question arises, why would you want to do this? The general question arises from the fact that radiologists, physicians, cardiologists, and neuroscientists, and so on, healthcare professionals in general, are highly trained and skilled professionals and practitioners. Now, as engineers and computer scientists and scientists outside the area of healthcare, we are now saying, do these procedures, get the information, get the image data, apply computers for this purpose, and do computer-aided diagnosis. So why would we want to suggest the use of computers for the analysis of biomedical images? There are a few different aspects. One, in general, human beings are highly skilled and fast in the analysis of visual data and information. When given a plot that shows temperature going up and down, somebody can very easily say, well, the temperature is fluctuating in this range and so on. Or given an image, it's very easy to say, this is a person, this is a desk, and this is a table, and so on. Or given an image, here are the ribs, and here are the lungs, and here is the stomach, and so on after some training. But the same human beings will be slow in arithmetic computation, arithmetic calculations with numbers. Computers, on the other hand, can perform arithmetic calculations very fast, millions of arithmetic computations per second. But computers are typically slow in recognizing visual patterns. The analysis of images by computers is not as fast yet as human beings can do in most cases. To train a computer to recognize visual patterns has been done and achieved to a certain degree of success, but it's not easy. Human beings can do it easier and faster. So there are these two issues. Computation is one, recognition is another. Computation, computers are fast and accurate. Human beings are not fast and liable to commit mistakes. Visual patterns, human beings are fast and efficient. Computers are still struggling to catch up. But human beings are affected by fatigue. not only fatigue, but also boredom. If you're asked to analyze hundreds of images one after another, you get bored. And we're also distracted by environmental factors. There's a sound and I turn around there, or something happens, I'm distracted by some other event, and I may lose something. My attention is taken away from what I'm doing, and I may miss something in the current case. And in a screening situation, when one is required to interpret several hundred images in half a day or a day, then it is possible that the human being affected by all of these factors will be susceptible to committing errors, even though the human being is efficient, more efficient than the computer in recognizing patterns in visual images. It is possible that the human being will commit errors in such a situation due to these factors. But a computer, of course, being inanimate and mathematically accurate, it's consistent. It's a machine, so it's not affected by these factors. So repetitive tasks can be easily left to computers, as long as it is specific and can be encoded. Analysis by humans is subjective and qualitative. I started with the example of measuring the temperature, or sensing the temperature, not measuring. So just put your palm and you can sense the temperature, but it is qualitative. All you're doing is sensing the difference between your temperature and the temperature of the other person, hotter or colder. And some grading of how much, a little warm or really high. Computers can, on the other hand, perform objective and quantitative analysis, and this is the most important point. One is subjective, the other is objective. One is qualitative, the other is quantitative. Now that itself is not a big deal. Quantitative analysis becomes possible by the application of computers to biomedical images, and the logic of medical or clinical diagnosis could then be objectively encoded. And the most important thing then is, once it is put into a computer for objective analysis, it can be applied consistently in routine or repetitive tasks by a computer. Quantitative analysis is important. You may want to ask, well, how much is the difference in temperature? Then you can measure it. But subjective versus objective, where does it matter? It matters in consistency. If you're performing only subjective analysis without making measurements, then there could be variation over time, what is called intra-observer variability. You yourself may give a certain opinion now about with the same data, and tomorrow you may give a different opinion with the same data. May not be tomorrow, but 3 months down the road when you have forgotten what you did with the same data set, your opinion may be different. So that is inconsistency. Even if you are an expert, well-trained, just by the nature of human analysis in a subjective manner, you will not be able to be consistent over time. And it could also be carelessness. If you're not careful, then you would be inconsistent. So it is improper application of knowledge or simply inconsistent application. Whereas computers would be consistent. And there is also another aspect, which is inter-observer variability, which is more serious. A given specialist may claim to be consistent. It is hard to lay that charge against an expert and say you are being inconsistent. But it is easy to show, and several studies have demonstrated this, that when you have multiple specialists, their opinions vary significantly. So there is inter-observer variability. They might all have gone to the same school, they might all have passed with the same grade, but their interpretation will be different with the same data. Now, this is why patients typically go for a second opinion or a third opinion. If you don't like the opinion given by your physician, you will say thank you and go and see another person until you get a satisfactory explanation of the condition that is affecting you, or you get the medicine you like, or the protocol that you like and handle. So inter-observer variability is also an issue when you have subjective and qualitative analysis. If you can make the analysis objective and quantitative, there is less scope for such variability. Not that there will be no variability. The final result may still vary, but the hope is that quantitative and objective analysis will lead to consistent results and the consistent application of that knowledge. So inter-observer and intra-observer variations would be the problem with human analysis, even with experts. So computers can apply a given procedure repeatedly and consistently. It is possible to encode the knowledge, the logical process. Now, knowledge is something beyond logical processes. At the basic level, you have the measurement, and then you have the data coming out of the measurement. And from that, you have some extracted information using all the processing that we can apply. From the information, you get the interpretation, which is a kind of knowledge. And from the knowledge, accumulating knowledge over years, you have the expertise or the skill that the person has developed. And above all of that, there is intuition. There is human intuition. The clinical expert does not simply look at the image and tell you you have this problem or that problem. That physician also looks at you and looks at your clinical history, your family history, and so on before arriving at a diagnosis. So the mere image that we analyze using a computer and detecting a tumor and marking it as cancer cannot lead to the final diagnosis. It's only a part of that process. So the logical processes that underlie the diagnostic process can be encoded. Computers can do not only numerical processing, but also logical processing. But when I say knowledge here, I mean only that logical process. So the collective intelligence of several human experts could be encoded to a certain extent. Then the question arises, what do you want? Computer-aided diagnosis or automated diagnosis? Typically, I argue for computer-aided diagnosis, and I want to make that as the most important observation here, that what we are doing here is to extract the information from the images and provide to the expert, and it is the expert who will make the final decision. So a physician or medical specialist typically uses other information in addition to images, including the appearance of the patient, the mental state, the family history, socioeconomic factors. Some of these can be quantified and entered into the computer or encoded, but not all. Some of them are not amenable to quantification and logic-based, rule-based processes. Biomedical images are said to be indirect indicators of the state of the patient. They're not the direct indicators. By that I mean the disease process has affected something, and that something is showing as a certain feature in the image. So it is an indirect link between the patient, that the condition that is affecting the patient, and what you are seeing in the image. So the lack of a direct or unique image to pathology relationship will create a difficulty. The results of image analysis need to be integrated with other clinical signs and symptoms and information by the specialist. And beyond all of that, there is the intuition of the medical specialist. So all the knowledge and training or years of practice would have given the specialist a certain sense that is beyond what can be encoded and what can be programmed. So for these reasons, it is better to work in the realm of computer-aided diagnosis than automated diagnosis. And then there is the domain of practice or the realm of practice. We are engineers and scientists. The physician is in the medical area, the medical domain, and we have some boundaries that we cannot cross due to the licenses that we have obtained. and our training. In the province of Alberta in Canada, I am a registered professional engineer. I can practice engineering. I can design something and put my stamp, but I cannot issue a diagnosis to a patient and put my engineering stamp on it. It's invalid. And even within engineering, my background is in electrical engineering, and it is expected that I would remain within that for which I'm qualified. If I were to design a bridge and put my stamp, I'm pretty sure the engineering association wouldn't like it. So there is also the legal aspect of practice of the profession. So considering all of these, it is best to leave the final decision to the physician. So it is expected that the quantitative and objective analysis that is facilitated by computers applied to biomedical images, image data that we acquire, would lead to a better diagnosis, a more accurate diagnostic decision, but by the physician. So we will not go into automated diagnosis. There are two quotes that I like that I have put in both of my books. And I have mentioned quantification or quantitative analysis as one of the important aims of image processing and image analysis, and the same for signal processing and signal analysis. And Lord Kelvin made the statement on the importance of quantitative analysis. When you can measure what you're speaking about and express it in numbers, you know something about it. But when you cannot measure it, when you cannot express it in numbers, your knowledge is of a meager and unsatisfactory kind. He said it may be the beginning of knowledge, but you have scarcely in your thoughts advanced to the stage of science. So science is based upon objective measurements, and you need to be able to do that to advance. And then assumptions made in quantitative analysis. We normally make several assumptions in designing our experiments and a certain mechanism for working. And Norbert Wiener said, things do not in general run around with their measure stamped on them, like the capacity of a freight car that says the capacity is so many tons of holding whatever it is you want to put in. It requires a certain amount of investigation to discover what their measures are. And what most experimenters take for granted before they begin their experiments is infinitely more interesting than any results to which their experiments lead. So he's saying that the assumptions we make are important and also very interesting. They could be limiting the nature of the work and the results that we do, the work that we do and the results we get, but they are important. That concludes the first chapter on image data acquisition and the nature of the data that we acquire and the kind of processing steps that we would apply, including why we would want to do these tasks. So let's pause a little bit and let me ask if you have any questions on what we have discussed so far.